Hi, this is Tom from the Happiness Quotient. Thank you for dropping by. You are one of my favorite listeners because if you're listening to this episode, you're hearing it before we changed our name to the Happiness Quotient. Just so you won't be surprised when you listen, you'll hear me talk about Baker Street with Tom Pollard. Believe me, you are in the right place. We've changed our name, but the excellence of the podcast just keeps getting better. Before we get to the episode, if you haven't done so already, please subscribe wherever you're listening, and I hope you'll visit my Patreon page for exclusive content at patreon.com/thehappinessquotient, and take a look at my YouTube page of the same name, where there are many Everest and music-related episodes, adventure-related podcast elements that can't be found here on the podcast itself. Thanks for being here. If you like what you hear, be sure to leave me a review, a rating, and share it with someone you care about. Now, on with the show. Welcome to Baker Street with Tom Pollard. Thank you for taking time out of your precious day to visit. Pull up a cozy chair, kick back, relax. Can I get you something to drink? A cup of coffee, tea, or proper tea? I think Sherlock Holmes would most definitely approve of a cup of proper tea. Maybe something a little more intoxicating if you're listening in the evening. Did you know that in the 18 or so months I've been bringing you stories that inspire from Baker Street, we've been heard across all the continents, literally. Well, technically, a friend of mine tried to listen when he was in Antarctica, but he couldn't get it to play. We've been to 74 countries and counting, including Guernsey. Guernsey, one of the Channel Islands in the English Channel near the French coast. A self-governing British crown dependency known for beach resorts and scenery of its coastal cliffs. We go far and wide here on Baker Street. All right, today we have a good one. An interview with an old friend of mine, Anne Miziozic Sarnoff. She is the head of Warner Media's Studios and Networks Group. Let's put that in some razor-sharp perspective. Anne Miziozic Sarnoff became the first woman ever to become a studio head of a major studio when she became CEO and chair of Warner Brothers. Now, I didn't even know there was that you could be promoted above that. I figured that was as far up as you could go, but in August, she was promoted to become the head of Warner Media's Studios and Networks Group. I'm really excited to bring this interview with her to Baker Street with Tom Pollard today. It's very inspiring, so stay tuned. The music that we're listening to was found on the Free Music Archive, and we're listening to the music of Jan Morgenstern. This is the score to the film Cinta. And we benefit because under the terms of Creative Commons licensing guidelines, I've provided a link to this music in his website. And because this is a non-monetized podcast, meaning nobody's making any money, we can use music under the Creative Commons licensing guidelines. Pretty cool. Beautiful stuff. Perfect for our subject for today. Somebody from a Hollywood studio. I had an intro written for today's episode about our changing times, life during not only COVID, but the culture of immediacy, having the world at our fingertips, and is what it takes to make it in the world different today than it was, say, when I was growing up in Wilbraham, Massachusetts, with today's guest. But, you know, I want to say something first about the divisiveness in our world. And as we're all aware, the leader of the USA tested positive for COVID-19 last week and was admitted to the hospital. And I was really interested to observe the different reactions that I saw and heard about this news. There were those who oppose him on Facebook and Instagram and other social media, literally dancing with delight, lighting candles, praying to the Archangel Michael for the swift passage of this man's life. And the word karma kept popping up. People saying, oh, karma's a bitch, ain't it? Or, well, he got the karma that he deserved. And, you know, as a student, well, a relative student of the teachings of the Buddha and ancient mystics, I hesitated at wagging a finger at those who proclaimed to know what a just karmic payback would be for another human being, let alone themselves. The generally understood idea of karma is that karmic consequences result from one's actions. So, for instance, if someone intentionally harms or kills another human being, karma steps in and, if you will, pays that person back. Maybe their spouse has an affair or their car is stolen. Beyond that, our intentions and our thoughts, those that we empower, those that we give strength to, really are what create the reality in which we as an individual live. So in that vein, thoughts and intentions are really as powerful as actions in relation to karmic consequences. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but what I'm saying is, if I'm in celebration of someone else's condition, someone who gets COVID, for instance, and I hug my friends and light a candle to hasten their death, because I believe they deserve such a fate, I'm no better than the actions of that person that I'm in judgment of, right? While I'm in judgment of an individual, portending to understand the complexities of that person's inner workings, I'm allowing hatred or fear to overwhelm me, and therefore I give away the power of my own soul. We don't even know if that person lives in a living hell, him or herself, or suffers in their own way in every breath they take. Do we think ourselves so godlike that we can assign death as the only just payback for perceived evil? It's like playing God. The deal here is that we have a choice of how we think, and how we think creates our moment-to-moment reality. If one prays for the death or suffering of another individual, no matter how evil we believe that they might be, is not that person who is doing the praying in a prison of their own making? It's really an easy choice. Come from a place of love. Let karma do whatever the hell karma is supposed to do. It doesn't require us to light a candle for it to move forward in time. I grew up in a little town in western Massachusetts in the northeast United States. Our little town, Wilbraham, Massachusetts, had a pharmacy in the center next to a barber shop. There was a bank and the village store where my mom would usually send me a couple of times a week to walk down just the short distance that it was from our house to get a loaf of bread or milk. Everybody knew everybody in town, and Vinny, the guy who ran the gas station across the street in the center of town, he'd fix a leak in your bicycle tire for a buck, or fix it and just send you on your way. Some that I went to high school with, it was called Minichog Regional High School, have gone on to do some amazing things. At Minichog, we have an astronaut, Janice Voss, a Major League Baseball pitcher, Mike Trombley, and the co-founder of ESPN, Scott Rasmussen, and today's guest, Anne Mizyazik-Sarnoff, was named the head of WarnerMedia's Studios and Networks Group in August 2020. In this role, Anne's responsible, now get this, for all of WarnerMedia's content-focused teams, uniting the Warner Brothers Pictures Group, HBO, HBO Max, the Warner Brothers Television Group, DC, which is DC Comics, Kids, Young Adults, Classics, including Cartoon Network, Adult Swim, Boomerang, TCM, Cartoon Network Studios, Warner Brothers Animation, TBS, TNT, True TV, Wizarding World, Consumer Products, and Gaming to work together across titles, brands, and franchises, an unmatched collection of world-class brands and content creators. Prior to joining Warner Brothers in 2019, Anne was president of BBC Studios Americas. She served as head of BBC Worldwide's Global Production Network. She was president of Dow Jones Ventures and senior vice president of strategy. And before that, COO for the Women's National Basketball Association. She had one time worked for Viacom as Nickelodeon's executive vice president for consumer products and business development. She was COO of VH1 and country music television. Whew. She has a BS from Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business and an MBA from Harvard Business School, sits on the board of PayPal Holdings, Inc., Georgetown University, and is the vice chair of the advisory board of the McDonough School of Business at Georgetown. Oh, man! Anne's greatest credit, this is the one it's the most important of all, is her kindness, her insight, authenticity, her intellect. She might have all those credits that I just listed off, but inside Anne is the same person I knew back in high school, and today I welcome her here to Baker Street with Tom Pollard. I called her at her home in Manhattan, and her interview is something every single parent should listen to with their children. Here is my conversation with Anne Mizziazik-Sarnoff on September 30th, 2020. Okay, I hear you, okay. And I see you. Hey, awesome. Oh my gosh. Long time no see.
Nice to see you.
I know.
It
has been
going?
A long time. Yeah, it's going good. Finally
awesome.
Back. Yeah.
Good,
yeah.
good.
I'm going to interject here real quickly to say that I had prepared over a dozen questions for Anne, and we got right off the bat chatting about life in Wilbraham, Massachusetts, and I had asked her about somebody who I thought was either her brother or cousin, and we never got to those dozen or so questions, and the conversation just took a beautiful turn right from there, but I got a lesson in people named Mizziazik in Wilbraham, Massachusetts. No kidding. So was he your cousin even, or third cousin?
No.
Two in the town. That's crazy. How do you get
actually, there was another family as well. You know, we lived in a section, a very immigrant-focused part of Wilbraham, where there were a lot of, you know, there were Polish neighborhoods, Portuguese neighborhoods, and I lived in the Polish neighborhood, and there were three families that were Mizziazik. Mishashik is the Polish name, but Polish pronunciation. But a lot of people had problems spelling that. So I tended to use Mizziazik when it came to, you know, school and other things where people are trying to, you know, figure out like, what, how do you spell that?
Yeah. So as a little kid,
a little more phonetic.
Right. Phonetic. Yeah. So as a little kid growing up, you know how a kid has to learn how to spell his or her name? Anne.
Yes.
A-N-N, you're sitting there with, you're helping the teacher.
M as in Mary, I, S as in Sam, I, A, S as in Sam, Z-E-K.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So, and you had to teach the teachers that probably 100 times, right?
Well, except that I have three older siblings. They're, you know, I was kind of a late in life baby. So they came, two of them came through Minichog, 13 and 11 years before me.
Wow. Yeah.
And my sister Betty in particular was a three sport athlete. So she, you know, like I played the same three sports as it turns out.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually had the same coach, Miss Polchapek, coached me for softball, who had actually her name was Miss Dunn when my sister was at Minichog. So we actually shared a coach. Yeah. So they knew the name from my two sisters.
So they blazed the trail for you. So what were your three sports? What did you play? And what did your sister?
I started with softball when I was very young because my sister would, you know, we'd play catch in the backyard. Mm. And I played for my grammar school. I was a pitcher as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then I made varsity freshman year at Minichog, which was kind of a big deal because, you know, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And then I took up basketball sophomore year at Minichog. And so I played that for those 3 years. So softball 4 years, basketball 3 years. And then junior year, believe it or not, I started field hockey and then played field hockey the last 2 years. So my junior and senior years, I was playing three sports, which was a lot.
Amazing. And you were probably, gut tells me you were getting pretty good grades at the time.
I did get good grades. Yes, I did.
Oh, my gosh.
Thankfully.
And you were never any trouble to your parents, I bet.
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. Not that I remember. Because I was, I had to kind of hold the fort. My siblings were already in college by the time I grew up. So it was me and my parents. So I was a pretty good daughter, you know, cleaning the house, getting dinner heated up, because my mom had to go back to work to help pay for, all the expenses in college for my older siblings. I was a good daughter and companion, I think, for them.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So you said your mom is working. Was she working was she taking care of the home during the day? And did she work at night or something? Or,
well, so they, my parents had three kids very early on in their marriage in their early 20s, three kids in 4 years. And then, my dad was a blue collar worker. Wow. He was a factory worker, a house builder. And then eventually when I was growing up, he was a greenskeeper at a local country club in our hometown up in Hamden. And so, and my mom was, she was a housekeeper, but then she went to work as a clerk in a company was called Latrix, I think, originally, and then to the local Sears Roebuck in the Eastfield Mall.
Wow.
And she was there for 25 years, first kind of back office, and then she worked in the catalog department for the last maybe 10 years.
Wow.
So if you were to pick up your catalog order back in the day when you had to go to the store to pick up an order, she would have been the woman who would have, Vera at Sears in the catalog, like all my friends knew her because they would go in to pick up their catalog orders. She was very, very sweet woman who would make conversation. So,
So they set a pretty darn good example for you. I mean, your parents taught by doing, it sounds like, right?
They were very, very hardworking and always taught me to be that way. Yeah. And kind of not complaining, and you do what you have to do, and we didn't have a lot of money, so I ended up working very early as well in my life, babysitting at first, and then I was a camp counselor at Speck Pond starting age 14. Do you remember that?
Yes, I sure do.
Off Boston Road.
Yeah.
And then I waitressed at Friendly's starting at age 16.
Wow.
In East Longmeadow. So I had two jobs in the summers, Spec in the day and Friendlies in the evenings.
Wow.
I was always working.
Wow.
And I helped, pay my way through college because we didn't really have a lot of savings or, any money to dip into. And in fact, both my parents have passed and my dad recently passed. So we were going through all of the paperwork and things that had been in the house. And we found my mom saved everything and she had a whole folder with my Georgetown acceptance and all the financial aid paperwork and her handwriting of like the columns of numbers to try to figure out whether we could afford for me to go to Georgetown. And they ended up giving me a good package of aid loans and work study and then grant money so that I could afford. I wouldn't be sitting here today, honestly, Tom, in this position if it weren't for Georgetown's new policy, which was right before we applied to college, they came up with a policy to be needs blind. So if you applied and got in, then they would meet your full financial need through, a variety of means. So that's why I'm sitting here today, because I was able to afford to go to Georgetown and it was a game changer for me.
Wow. Oh, that's really incredible. So you go to Georgetown, you did well there, but it sounds like you already had your sights kind of set, had broader horizons, like, okay, because a lot of people graduate after 4 years, whether you have a law degree or whatever it is you're going after, you kept going. You had dreams. Am I making an assumption here, or?
You know, probably not as foreshadowing as you're giving me credit for. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. So I didn't have a lot of role models in my life of how to pursue a career. Mm. It was really more about just do your best and try to, try to get ahead whenever you could. Mm. But I didn't know about careers, or, you know, even at Georgetown, I was a marketing major, and I was working a lot, again, to try to cover costs. And I worked at a law firm, I worked at an advertising agency, I worked at Pizzeria Uno, waitressing on weekends. And when I graduated from Georgetown, I really didn't know where to go. As a marketing major, there weren't a lot of companies back then recruiting. And so I ended up taking a job in consulting, which, again, didn't really know what strategy consulting was, but it was a boutique consulting firm right across the bridge in Virginia. Mm. And that was another kind of sliding doors, opening a new pathway in my life, because then I was now in a small firm, but in the company of people who were MBAs and, professional consultants. And a year later, there were 5 analysts, 2 partners, and the other 4 analysts were applying to get their MBA. So I kind of went with the tide of, well, maybe I should get an MBA. Hmm. So again, I wasn't as premeditated in my ambition as it may look in retrospect. Hmm. I was more, exposed to different communities and different opportunities as I kind of made it up as I went along.
Yeah, that's kind of cool, because the interesting thing is there's such a wide variety of creative ways that people get to where they're going. And that's a perfect example of it. You might be premeditated, I hope to one day run a beautiful company or something like that. But the truth is that you find people who influence you, you become inspired by those people or the things that people are doing, and kind of go for it. For me, I've always been a real intuition gut guy. This doesn't feel right, that feels right, and this makes sense, that doesn't make sense, but it's like in my heart more than anything. And that's it. So you went on and got your MBA, and wow, you were busy. You were busy from high school on, or before, I should say.
I don't think I ever really took a lot of time to think about it. I just kept going, honestly. And it, if it felt right and it felt like I was challenging myself, I always felt like I was challenging myself, then I kept on that road. And then post my MBA, I went back into a larger consulting firm. I didn't really know what industry I wanted to go into, because again, I didn't have much exposure to business growing up. That's just not what our household was all about. So I went back into consulting because I thought, well, I'll get exposed to a wide variety of different situations and different businesses. And so I was, I think I was really trained well, because this firm that I went into was a great training ground for what it was like to eventually work in a company. It taught me how to read P&Ls and understand how the stock market works and how companies are valued and why people invest in certain companies and not other companies, and how to maximize the value of the division or company that you're working for. So it was really, in addition to my MBA, a great training ground for me. And then a few years later, my husband and I had our first child, and I decided I wanted to, at this point, I knew I wanted to get into the media business, because I had more exposure to different industries, and my husband was in book publishing at the time. So then I got my foot in the door at Viacom and in corporate strategy, corporate development, and spent the next 10 years there. Wow. 1 year in corp dev, and then the next 5 years at Nickelodeon, which was a real turning point for me, because I went from strategist to then running one of the businesses at Nickelodeon, the consumer products business, and mm-hmm. helped to build out the business of Nickelodeon to grow from a television channel to more of a multi-pronged franchise business. So I don't know, you know, if your kids were Nickelodeon fans, but at the time we were launching shows called Rugrats and then Blue's Clues and then SpongeBob, Dora the Explorer. And so I helped make those programs into 360, we called it 360 brands, meaning now we had toys and games and books and theme park attractions, et cetera. So mm-hmm. my job was to build out those brands beyond the television, the wonderful television shows that they were.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously that, well, for me at least, our kids grew up, that's the fabric of the early years of my kids growing up, you know, watching a lot of those shows. And it's amazing how much it is goes across everything that you do. So you obviously did a great job in that. And you know, we had what was the on Dora the Explorer, they had the little fox like Swiper or something.
Swiper.
Like that. Yeah, Swiper, no Swipe. And my kids were like really into that guy, like, oh, here he comes. And but
I remember the backpack. There was the backpack song.
I'm not gonna sing the song right now. I promise, okay. No singing of backpack. But you could, if you're interested in, you know, rehearsing for us live here on Baker Street.
No singing. But it's great that your kids had such an emotional connection.
Yeah.
To the show, and as did mine. I had two young kids at the time, so it was. I mean, honestly, you couldn't have chosen a better job to have when you have two young kids. I would bring them into the office and they thought I had the coolest job. I mean, they didn't even know that there were other kinds of jobs. They just thought, oh my God, I love where my mom works.
Yeah.
We had, you know, the walls were painted orange. We had ping pong tables and we had recess in the afternoon because it was almost cult-like. We were so obsessed with super serving kids and not talking down to them and really being respectful of who kids were, that we themed our audiences, or I'm sorry, our offices according to our audience. And so it was like a playground in many ways. So my kids loved coming into the office.
Yeah, you were like a rock star or a sports star or something like that, right? You know.
Yeah. And in fact, when I got an offer to move over to a sister division, VH1, after 5 years at Nickelodeon, and my daughter cried. She was like, "I like your job. I don't want you to leave." And I had to like think quickly on my feet, like, "Oh, what's at VH1 that she might like?" And so I immediately said, "Well, have you heard of the Backstreet Boys?" And she stopped. You know, the tears dried up a little, and I said, "Well, you know, mommy's new job has to do with the music business and." There's some, you know, anyway, so
right,
you get
right.
the point. She quickly pivoted to, oh, I like mommy's new job too.
You grew with your kids. Yeah. All right, we're graduating from Dora the Explorer to Backstreet Boys.
Yes,
pretty cool.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting because it's this really natural trajectory, if you will, and for lack of a better word, trajectory sounds like it got shot out of a cannon or something. But you followed this course that just seemed really natural to you. And I think now that I think about this, the last time I actually saw you was when you were working at the WNBA down in New York.
Yes.
So that's kind of a different jump, you know. And
was that a high school reunion that we saw each other?
No,
at?
I think I drove down to New York with my brother, and I met you. I went up to your offices, and we sat down for probably a half hour.
Oh, yes.
Probably showed you some videos I had been producing or something. You know, I don't know. Maybe I thought there was an opportunity to do some work for the WNBA or something. But I don't know if it was just fun to catch up and. And I love going to New York too. And so, but then you moved on from the WNBA, which is a pretty cool project,
yeah,
I would imagine.
Yeah, I've had some cool jobs. I mean, to your point, Tom, it was kind of a fluid path. And again, not very premeditated because I didn't have a grand objective. I more just wanted to keep finding interesting things to do. And honestly, it's like doors opened. Mm. And I tell young people when I mentor them, you know, just do right by the company. Don't focus on yourself as much as your boss and the company and making them successful, and doors will open for you. Like, work really hard, stay focused. Hmm. And that, because that's the journey that I had, and it worked. And I'm not trying to be naive about, you know, you do have to obviously network and look out for yourself and all the rest of it. But I do think if you have the true north of really doing an excellent job in the here and now, mm-hmm. that doors will open for you. Because many of the jobs I've had were either people hiring me who knew me from prior jobs, or people who knew people who had, you know, worked with me. So the world gets very small, and your reputation kind of, you know, is meaningful. And if you're known as being somebody smart who does a good job, then, you know, that helps open doors. Mm. So that's how my career unfolded. And so I'm, you know, it's an interesting journey that I'm very, very pleased with. Mm. But again, you know, never, I think people who set too high of a goal or too prescriptive a goal sometimes find themselves disappointed because they didn't get to that point. Mm-hmm. But if you keep yourself open to lateral thoughts, like for me, the WNBA, I hadn't intended to go into sports, but somebody introduced me to the commissioner, Stern, and Adam Silver, the now commissioner. And so, you know, I was open to that. Hmm. So again, you know, if I had just been thinking, no, I've got to climb to the top of a media company, I might not have taken that job.
Right.
But truthfully, it was an amazing job, and it gave me a window into the sports world and the connectivity between media and sports. And it's a different kind of version of star power, obviously. Mm-hmm. Instead of actors and actresses, it's these amazing women who were the top of their sport, Olympic gold, you know, athletes, and they were truly inspiring to me. So every step along the way, I've really been, you know, very, very, grateful and lucky to have, you know, had so many different opportunities in my career that have really dimensionalized me as a person. Mm. So, yeah.
Wow. So I love how you said, you know, when you mentor someone or even just by example, it's not all about me kind of thing, because I think in our generation that is coming up now, and this isn't a condemnation of anything at all to do with the, if you will, the youth that is coming out of college or high school today, but things are instantaneous in this world. It's like right here, I've got this cell phone and I can post something or I can receive messages. And I think there's a potential for people to become really impatient. And so your message is put the company first. Obviously, you have to take care of your own needs. You can't say, well, I might, you know, languish here for 50 years, but the company, so not so selflessly, but that's a really good message, because I don't think, I don't hear that a lot these days. Is that?
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
And there might be some generational things in there. I don't want to stereotype, but it is, I think it does. Also, I think it's contextual in terms of how you were brought up. And for me, one of the things I've talked about is having played sports, team sports in particular, was a very formative thing for me. So again, like, think about it. When you're playing, there's no I in team, right? So when you're playing a team sport, you really do have to have the focus of the whole team winning. It's not about you, it's about the team. Mm. And because I've been playing sports for so much of my life, and it was very formative for me in my development, I do think that's where I got, in addition to my, of course, my parents, but I think that's where I got a lot of my attitude towards the workplace, believe it or not. I think, you know, the sports the sports training helped me be a good team player when I got into the workplace.
Yeah. I'm like chuckling inside right now because in high school, I was a swimmer, an individual sport.
And then, I remember that.
And then I latched on to mountain climbing after that. And that's how I made my career, doing the most, you know, alone kind of possible thing you can do. However, that said, I, you know, as my kids grew up, it was my intent to try to at least have a hand in coaching every team that they were on, and whether I was a head coach or just an assistant coach, football, baseball, basketball, and up at least sixth, seventh, eighth grade. And wow, you have to be really understanding of how diverse kids are and people are, and how it's a mini democracy, if you will, but with a with a head coach who the final word is his or her rule, if you will. But it's a lesson in selflessness and fairness, and I've seen a lot of teams that didn't display that, but no, that seems like
you were on the swim team, as I recall,
yes,
right? So
yes.
there is a team dynamic, and you're an individual performer towards a higher cause, which is the team meet, right? The swim meet.
Yeah.
So, and even, you know, I watched your Everest documentary, and you guys were a team climbing that mountain.
This is true.
Right? You couldn't have done it on your own. So I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit for the teamwork.
That's really cool.
In those pursuits.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's you're right. And I think I was just, there was a slight self-deprecating humor aspect of it. But I will say the 2019 expedition to Everest was probably the best expedition I've ever been on. And I didn't summit. I got sick, as you know from having watched it. I had a TIA, mini stroke. And but the reason it was the best expedition ever was because the cohesiveness and fair interworking nature of that team was greater than the sum of almost all the other expeditions I'd ever been on. A group of people who were just, we are all in this together. And so yes, thank you for helping me dovetail that to, you know, being not just an individual guy, but a team guy. Well, so tell me a little bit about what are you doing now? You said that in August you had a new position. You're with Warner Brothers.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about your position and kind of in a nutshell how it came to be and what your charge is.
Sure. So for the last 9 years, from 2010 to 2019, I was at the BBC on the entertainment side, running the Americas business for the BBC. So we imported a lot of amazing shows like Doctor Who and Planet Earth and Top Gear. And then we had a channel here called BBC America, which made great shows like Orphan Black and Killing Eve. And so I was running that business and then was recruited to become the CEO of Warner Brothers. And that was in August of 2019. So I became bi-coastal and you know, our kids are grown. So it was kind of a grand adventure for me and my husband. And that has been a great, that's just been a really amazing new phase to my career. And I was the first woman after 97 years of history of Warner Brothers. So that was also a very proud moment for me and for, you know, trailblazing women behind me. I've always felt a tremendous responsibility to pave the path for women. And then a couple of months ago, we restructured the broader company, Warner Media, and I was given a new position of overseeing the content areas for Warner Media, content and studios. So I'm chair and CEO of Warner Media Studios and Networks. So that includes Warner Brothers Television, Warner Brothers Motion Pictures. But now, in addition to that, HBO Max, our new streaming service, and the Turner Networks, TNT, TBS.
Incredible.
That's Sorry, fine. Can you hear the phone?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Hey, we got life goes on. You might hear my cat getting a chipmunk, so we just let it all happen here. So
the phone never rings. The house phone never rings.
And yeah. Of course.
When you're taping something, right?
My competition is trying to mess me up here. So all right, start calling the house.
Yeah. So it's. It's a similar position, but it's expanded on the content side, mm-hmm. and the company is now structured differently. But I still get to work with the amazing creative talent at Warner Brothers and now have additional responsibilities for the content of HBO, HBO Max, and the Turner Networks. So it's really great. It's of course, you know, in COVID, the whole world is a little bit upside down, and we had to stop production back in March. Mm-hmm. of 70 TV shows, Warner Brothers TV shows, and 20 feature films that were in production. And now we're gradually getting them back up into production. We've developed new safety protocols for production and negotiated with all the guilds to make sure that everybody feels comfortable in returning to production. And so thankfully, things are starting to get back in action, but it's going to be gradual, right? And we need to make sure that we can, you know, make people feel safe, but also people are hungry for new content. So we're anxious to make new TV shows, make new movies. The theaters are trying to, you know, kind of get back up and running. We actually released a feature film called Tenet, Christopher Nolan's new movie. And it's doing very well overseas. In the U.S., there are some key markets like New York and L.A. and San Francisco that haven't opened yet. But as I said to the press a few weeks ago, that it's a marathon, not a sprint, because, look, we're in a pandemic and certain states are doing better than others in terms of the, you know, the COVID counts. So we'll be patient with that and see how we go. But we, you know, we're very interested in keeping theaters up and running and trying to help wherever we can.
You had, when we spoke, I think we talked in third week in July or something on the telephone. And at the time there was a little, well, it's still going on, I know, but there was, other than COVID, there was a lot of disruption happening, particularly in the United States with protests and things like that. And without getting into the specifics or details of it, you mentioned that not just at Warner Media or Warner Brothers, that overall in the entertainment world, you were thinking that it was time for, I think you even said literally, meta reset, like things kind of rethink where we're going and the direction that we're moving things. Is that right? And do you still feel that way given a couple of months have gone by?
Well, I think what's happening is there's a lot more openness to hearing people's voices and a diversity of voices. You know, 3 years ago, you had the Me Too movement come across the culture, really, but certainly all of LA and Hollywood, and so that was a reset. And there's a new awareness, there's a new consciousness, there's a new voice given to women as a result of that. And now I think this, you know, I don't know if it's a reset as much as an evolution, that there's a desire on my part for sure. And I believe the industry to make sure that a wide variety of voices are heard and different stories are being told. And, you know, we want to be able to be the best place for all kinds of storytellers. So I think we talked about David Makes Man, which is a show I love and is on the OWN network, the Oprah Winfrey Network, about a young boy, 12-year-old, growing up in the projects, but he's in a magnet school, so he has to commute there every day while he's also trying to help take care of his younger brother because his mom is a single working mom. And, you know, it just really shines a light on how difficult it can be to break through and have opportunity when you come from an underprivileged place. So again, I want to tell those stories. I want to be able to have the best talent and have them be able to just really serve different audiences and tell new stories.
Mm. Yeah, it certainly appears to be happening, and from the looks of it, the company was ahead of the curve, in my estimation. Not that I did exhaustive research on that topic, but it seemed so. And David Makes Man is a great example, and it resonated with me because I had, you know, done the interview in a recent episode with a man who runs a school in Brooklyn, in the most violent neighborhood of Brooklyn, and he serves this constituency of elementary school kids, and it turns out it's the most successful elementary school in Brooklyn, given what they're trying to do. And wow, really inspiring. So it's my dream.
I listened to that episode. I loved it. Mm. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, I'm glad you did.
He was incredibly inspiring.
Yeah, A.B. Whitfield. I'm going to go down there in hopefully October. My plan is to go down with Stu, who I interviewed at the beginning of that episode, and do some interviews down there. And when I find out when that's going to happen, I'll definitely let you know, because who knows, maybe you could come in and say hi to and meet
AB. I would love to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to.
And I know you're a hugely busy person, so I'm trying to find a way to kind of wrap this up, other than the gratitude I feel that you took time out of probably a very busy day. What's the future look like? You know, real quick, the short-term future, the prognosis. Do you feel like COVID is teaching us to do things more efficiently, better? I'm a silver lining kind of guy, so I can tell. And
yeah.
So we're suffering a little bit, but are we going to be better off down the road because of it?
I certainly hope so. I feel that there are silver linings already. I think we're appreciating family and friends more than ever. I think for me personally, I'm certainly appreciating the workplace more than ever, because I miss my colleagues. I miss being with them in the office every day. I don't think I'll ever take that for granted again. Mm-hmm. And isn't that ironic when, you know, kind of people go to work every day saying, gosh, I wish I could just work from home once in a while, and here we are. So we have now been plunged into the other operating mode, and I think people now will have a new appreciation. You can't not appreciate that, having been deprived of that for all these months, and hopefully for not too many more months. But I also think, back to the point about diverse storytelling, I think there will be a new set of creativity that comes out of this. And, you know, again, people are living through all kinds of different circumstances right now. So I'm really intrigued to see the kinds of stories, both in our television world and in our movie world, that come out of this, and how people write you know, screenplays and what stories they want to tell on television. We have a wonderful movie that we're going to release next year called In the Heights, which is Lin-Manuel Miranda's first Broadway musical, which preceded Hamilton, as you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's a story about celebrating Hispanic culture. It's a very feel-good movie, and I can't wait to release it. So I think we'll want to be together in celebrating when we can come out of the other side of the virus. Mm. And so other than that, Tom, honestly, I don't know. I'm just hoping and praying for a quick recovery, and that we all can really, you know, keep with us the things that we learned through this very difficult period and grow as a result of it.
Mm. Fantastic. Well, it's so great talking to you. I appreciate you taking the time out.
Of course. I really enjoyed it. And I hope to see you when you come down to Brooklyn.
Anne, thank you so much for taking the time to visit with me. I really appreciate your time and interest in sharing your story. It's inspiring to hear a story about how hard work, honesty, and kindness is really the key to moving along or climbing up to the top of the ladder. And you have done that in just the most wonderful way. Thank you. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will share it with your friends and family. Baker Street comes to you purely from the love of doing it. I don't make a penny, but I receive infinitely from your kindness and support, and you can show me that by sharing it. Please do, anywhere and everywhere, on social media, email, or word of mouth. It makes a big difference. And if you find me on Apple Podcasts, please subscribe to me and leave me 5 stars if you think it deserves that, and a review. I'd love to hear from you. Look for me at eyesopenproductions.com or email me at tom.dharma.pollard@gmail.com. Tom has an H, T-H-O-M, as does Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A. And if you want to learn more about Warner Brothers, who are graced by our friend Anne, go to warnerbros.com, WarnerBros.com. Lastly, we create our reality with the thoughts we empower. Stay positive. Focus on keeping your thoughts pure. Release any thoughts of doubt, which are fed by fear, because fear is the opposite of love. Love is infinitely more powerful than fear. The few voices that we hear that come from love, such as your own perhaps, destroy fear at a massive rate. There are millions and millions of individuals overwhelmed by fear, fed by the gigantic fear machine of social media. By sharing one positive word with one person, especially our young people and students, you can make a difference in that person's life. And you know, while we're at it, you have everything you need right inside of you, full of knowledge and wisdom, all that you will ever need to find joy and attract kindness and love. Stay positive, vanquish fear. Be well, and I will see you real soon. If you're still here, thank you for visiting. I hope you'll take a moment to subscribe wherever you're listening, and I hope you'll also visit my Patreon page for exclusive content at patreon.com/thehappinessquotient, and take a look at my YouTube page of the same name, where there are many Everest and music-related episodes, as well as adventure content and interview snippets that can't be found here on the podcast. Thank you for being here. I hope you'll share this, leave me a review, a rating, and come back soon.